Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Collider Ladies Night. I am beyond thrilled to welcome Mackenzie Davis to the show to talk about her new series, Station 11, which is excellent, and you are phenomenal in it. But I love so much of your work, and we're going to get to so much of it today.
Thanks, Perry.
Before we even get to a single film, though, I didn't warn you about this. What we start the show with is the dice tower behind me. I've got 8 random questions in front of me. I roll the die 3 times, and whatever I land on, that's where we start at least.
Oh my God, I love games. Please go.
Oh, I got you well covered in that department. All right, we're starting with a number 7, which is movie and TV skills. If you could learn a new skill or about a different profession through a role, what would you choose?
I remember there was a time in, and I was shooting The Halt and Catch Fire where I really wanted to go to the Body Farm, which is like a forensic, like crime scene. Anyways, I was some sort of forensic investigator farm where they just like let human remains rot in different areas, like underground, in a pool, in a trunk, so that when you like discover the bodies, you can see what like what happens to a body that's held. They you can date it, basically. It's like carbon dating for bodies. And I really wanted to go there, and I like had one of the producers offer to like write me a letter saying that I needed to go for work, but it felt like kind of disrespectful. Anyways, I'd like to do that. I think it would be really interesting. And what was the other part of the question? That's a job.
Oh, one or the other, either a new skill or a profession.
I think I'd love somebody to just force me to finally become fluent in French instead of pretending when I drink, you know.
I mean, pretending when you drink is a million steps further than I got. I tried real hard at French and Hebrew, spent many, many years studying, and just retained absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I retained some, but so little that it's like you can't really piece it together in any satisfying way. So that would be great.
All right. I'm still impressed. Roll number 2 here. All right. We're going to a number 4. 4 is binge watch. What is the most recent TV show that you have binge watched?
I binge watched, this is sort of too much maybe, but Selling Sunset season 4 fast. And then I was like, where did all this start again? So I rewatched seasons 1 through 3 to just be like, I just really want to know where all of these things happen. I think a lot of it happened off screen, so I didn't get a lot of answers, but it is interesting watching people from like year 1 of a reality show to year 4 of a reality show and how the many ways in which they change.
I have never seen it. I guess maybe I could give it a shot. And
no, it's not good. It's not that it's good. It just is there, and that's nice.
Sometimes you need content that's just there.
Yeah.
Last roll for you now. Going with a number three to close this out. It is never again. What is something that you did for a role that now makes you say, I'm really glad I did that, but never again?
I think Terminator, like, I don't know, never again. I just ate so much meat, like 5 times a day, unseasoned. Like thinking about how much meat I consumed, like, really disgusts me. And I love meat. Just kind of, yeah. Which I know is not really in vogue right now, but, enjoy flesh. But I really found consuming it as like the primary meal and the like primary source of nutrition was pretty gross.
I'm impressed that you made it through that. When I think about like getting fitter and healthier, and then I think about the reality of what it takes to do that, like, yeah, it's fine. I need my sandwiches, my beers.
It's not like supplements and smoothies. It's like just unseasoned chicken.
Absurd amount of unseasoned lean protein.
Yeah.
Let's, I guess, get into the meat of it now, pun intended. I always like starting with this question just so I can know the first steps. What is the movie, the performance, personal experience, you name it, that first made you say, I have to be an actor?
It wasn't really like that for me. I just like kind of was always performing and acting growing up. And then, you know, that starts out in a really annoying way, I think, for your family. And then you are in like acting clubs, and that's really fun because it's a club and all the kids are playing, and then you get to be in plays after school, and that's fun because there's pizza, and then you find a different way into it. And I don't know, it wasn't like I saw someone do it and wanted to do it. I just always wanted to do it. But I know, like, there are, you know, like Laura Dern in Wild at Heart, I still think about all the time, is like, wow, how many people she embodied in that one movie, and how much like sex and love and like pride and loyalty. Like, I don't know. She's just such a complex, amazing, unusual character. I love that movie and I love that performance so much.
I haven't thought about that movie in forever. I need a rewatch. So then the next step after that, when did it become something you wanted to commit to as a career? Actually, backtrack first, because of school. Did you study acting when you went to college, or did that first start at Neighborhood Playhouse?
Yeah, that started at Neighborhood Playhouse. I did English Lit at college and then at university. And then studied it full-time when I went to the Neighborhood Playhouse. But I was always like, it's just always been a part of my life. Like, it was always an extracurricular thing, but like the thing I like to do more than anything else. I just didn't make that sort of mental switch of it being a career, even though I always thought I was heading in that direction. It seemed like that happened after this and after this and after this. And then I reached the point where it had to start happening. And then that's when I did it full time. But until then, it was like still a big part of my life, just not, I wasn't studying it and I wasn't doing it professionally. But boy, did I like it.
For the studying part, why did you choose Neighborhood Playhouse? Was it the particular technique that they leaned into?
Kind of. I was in this Meisner class in Montreal where I was going to university, and with this really amazing teacher called Jacqueline McClintock, who went to the Neighborhood Playhouse. And, you know, anybody who's been to an acting class knows that they are little cults. And this one was no exception, but with a very benevolent sort of amazing leader. And yeah, she just spoke so highly of it. And also, like, not for nothing, I'm like a Canadian. I needed a work visa to work in the States. I got into the Neighborhood Playhouse. I like love the Meisner technique, had a great time at the school, but there are practicalities as well to that decision that one has to make.
Very, very understandable. So what happens after you leave the studying environment and you want to build a career? Is it basically the traditional audition grind until something hits?
Kind of. I was kind of aimless because I graduated from the Neighborhood Playhouse and didn't have an agent. I had somebody who would like sometimes send me auditions, but not really. And so I was just trying to do like what you see in montages in the movies, like looking at the back of magazines and going on Craigslist for student films. And I just didn't know how to navigate anything. And some of the advice I'd been given was a bit dodgy. like sending like postcards with your face on it to different casting agents announcing your arrival in the city. That just felt sort of, I wasn't sure exactly how you had to do it. And then I got really lucky in one of the like two auditions I was sent out on by this, this person who was sometimes sending me out on things, was for this movie called Breathe In. That was the first thing I was cast in, and was just like, I got really lucky. I kind of got to jump forward a few steps in a time where I was like very, very, very lost about how one moves forward at all.
So first impressions are everything. So what was it like making Breathe In at the very beginning of your career, especially because Drake has a really unique way of making his movies. So I imagine it would set certain expectations for future films that other directors can't quite match in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. His films are super intimate and so collaborative, and you work without a script, which, like, for me, I'd gone to a school that prioritized improvisational, like, listening and thinking and reacting and acting. So I wasn't really prepared to do anything technical and couldn't, but I could, like, go into a room and be, you know the parameters of a story and then sort of live within those parameters. Thank God that they're this like very specific, not even skill, but like thing had a place to be applied on the perfect movie. So I did know at the time, like, this isn't how movies are made. Like, you just got to be the luckiest person to have the one thing you know how to do right out of school be the one way that this person's making a movie. So I kind of, yeah, knew how lucky it was at the time.
So you get that gig without an agent and a manager. Did that film change the team that was around you and give you access to those resources that would keep those auditions coming?
Yeah, I didn't have an agent, didn't have a manager, and then I went to LA after that movie to like take meetings. It sounded really cool at the time. And I did take some meetings and then signed with my agents, who I'm still with the same agency today, and got a manager and yeah. And then I was like auditioning for real things. It was such a swift sort of, I mean, it was so cool at that time, because I went from like not even knowing how to get an audition for anything that wasn't like a non-union student film, to then auditioning and not being considered for, but like auditioning for real movies. I just felt so lucky to even be auditioning for real things. I was like, just sort of tickled for a long time. Like, oh my God, like, I don't even need to get it. It's just so fucking cool that I get to like read a real script and audition for a real thing, because I could not figure that out before.
I love hearing about longstanding actor-agent relationships, and we never really get to talk about them. So what was it about your agency that you got right at the beginning that felt right to you? And I guess, how have they supported you in all your projects over the years that makes you feel like there's some, this is a group of people that I can go the distance with and grow the way that I want with?
Yeah, I think it's, it's really special. I mean, at the time it was weirdly pragmatic, because there's a sort of energy of competition of like signing a new person, I guess. And I was really sensitive to that nobody, because I just shot this movie, had any idea what my work looked like. And the only people that did were the agents at the agency that I was signing with, because they represented the director. So they were kind of the only people I could believe, where I was like, all right, well, at least you've seen something. Everything else feels like true or not. And the very nice people, like, they don't know what I'm like or how I act. So they couldn't possibly actually like me. I'm just something that's this thing that was cast in this cool director's movie. So yeah, it was like kind of pragmatic in that way. And then I just settled with a really lovely team of people that understood who I was and never tried to push me into things. I mean, the sort of horror stories, or even just like kind of shitty stories that you hear about especially young actors being pushed into projects that they don't want, or in meetings with people that they don't want, or not being like listened to or respected, or sort of working with people, especially when that power dynamic is so stark, where you're just like, why are you even talking to me? I've never made you money. And I'm like, sort of, you know, you feel very deferent to the sort of agent relationship when you first start out. But they always treated me like smart and like an equal, and they were really interested in what I wanted to do and how I wanted to be. And I love that. And that's true to this day. They've really sort of respected my whole approach.
With that in mind, very big, broad question. What would you say is, I guess, the film that most well represented what you wanted to bring to your career, your craft, and to the world? Like a role in a film that felt like, yes, this is the side of me that I want this industry and I want audiences to see the most, at least.
I don't know, because there's not just like one thing, because when you've done it, then you're like, well, I want to show a different side, and like, I want someone to think that I could be this other thing. And so that's kind of part of the excitement, is that you keep trying to find sides of yourself that you haven't shown or done before that might interest you, and that like hopefully you can access and show. But I think I was speaking about Always Shine, this movie that I made with my friend Sophia, and that we both like, she's an actress as well, and we both feel like we're always chasing that feeling of what it's like to act and make stuff before there's money involved. Because like, as soon, the more expensive something gets, and when it becomes your career, the less it feels like it did when you fell in love with it. Not always, but like, you really have to fight for it to resemble the part where you're like, we have all the time in the world. Let's just like figure out what this is about. And what's important is that we like connect. And I don't know. Yeah, I always feel like a sort of dorky, but it's being in acting classes, because they're cults when you're younger, are like, it's so fun and secret and cool. And I don't know, you think that that's what being a professional actor is, and for many reasons, it shouldn't be. But there's still a sort of high of feeling like you're being pushed and exploring in a way that requires a lot of time and space to do. I've lost the sort of grammar of that sentence. But anyways, I think that movie, Always Shine, most closely resembled the way I like to make things, which is like, small group of people, everybody's equally invested. There's no like director actor hierarchy and then other, you know, it's like everybody is invested in this thing that we're all making, and we're all equal parties, and there's lots of time to explore and to like play with the ideas, and it's as much fun to do it as it is to talk about why we're doing it, or what these things make us think about. It's like camp. It's just, it was so fun. So I love that sort of thing that's both like kind of intellectually and emotionally
I'm so glad you brought up that film. I will always prioritize Sophia and Amy Simons's work, because I made a short, and the first film festival I ever got into with a little short was in a program with one that she directed called Coffee and Pie. And it's just the two of them sitting at a table having a conversation. But I was so excited that I went to every single screening of our program. So I think I saw that short like 6 or 7 times by the end of
That's
the week.
That's so cool.
I'll never forget it. And ever since, both of them, I always see everything they do.
Yeah. And they're both really great, cool, innovative people. Yeah.
Real one-of-a-kind voices, which is another exactly reason why I love them both so much. So jumping from what you just described to something like The Martian, because you had been on a whole bunch of sets before then, but, you know, being on one with $100 million plus price tag directed by Ridley Scott is a pretty big leap there. So what would you say surprised you the most about what it means to make a movie on that scale with, you know, people who are essentially industry icons?
I think what surprised me, because I'm like a fan and nervous and never know how I'm gonna like fit in those environments, was how unbelievably collaborative and intimate it still was. I mean, I guess I'm less surprised by that stuff now, but you know, you always expect that it's a different rarefied world, the one that you look at and idolize growing up, that when you step into that world, like it's like going through what are those like portals you'd walk through in like a sci-fi movie where it's like, but you sort of change in some way when you pass
through
it.
It's the wrong word. Now I'm thinking like a wormhole.
It's not, it's like, it would be the material of Alex Mack, but you don't go liquid, but you sort of like pass through a thing. Anyways, maybe not the point of the story. I thought Ridley Scott was like so fun and interested in what everybody thought and gave the actors so much license to do what they felt was right, and really like empowered us and me to enjoy the thing that we were making. I thought he really did, I mean, in relationship to Sophia's movie, like really did take time and give us time, but also had the sort of expertise of having done it for 40 years where he's not overshooting or unsure of what we're doing. And that felt so safe and cool to be like, oh, I'm in the hands of somebody who knows exactly what they're making, and we're not doing more than he needs, but we'll do as much as I need as well, which it was really exciting. I love being in that movie.
It sounds like an ideal balance there. You know, I have to talk about Halt and Catch Fire. I think that was the first thing I had ever seen you in, and I grew so obsessed with that show. Aww. How was it making the switch to filming in the series format? What's something you really appreciated about the way a television show was made that maybe you couldn't get on a film set?
Well, it was really early. It was like, I'd done maybe like 2 or 3 movies by the time I got cast in it. So it was really fresh in my career. And I feel like it was going to like university for acting. Like I was so in awe of the people that I worked with. I learned so much from them. I was just like absorbing all of their behavior and their work ethic and the way they approach things. And I was working with great actors and people who they were great people to be learning that stuff from, and then carving out what my way into this was. So it was just like, I look back on it now and I'm like, wow, I'm so lucky to be on that show and to work with showrunners like Chris and Chris, the Chris's, who again, I mean, I think all these things are like people who really early on in my career treated me with like validity and interest, and like I was as much a part of the thing as, you know, Lee Pace was, you know, like that my point of view and opinion mattered, and my notes or the things that didn't feel right to me mattered just as much, and I was just treated like such an equal on that show, and it was so lucky for me. But what's different about it from movies? I don't know. I've said this before, but it really is my favorite thing, is there's like a little cheat with TV, especially on a series like Halt, where for 4 years I like experienced things through Cameron and her relationship to Joe and to Gordon and to Donna and to Boz. And then in season 3, some conversation happens with one of them, and I'm having like real memories of a hurt or a love that I experienced in real time as Cameron like 2 years ago that are now sort of woven into my nervous system as my memories, where they're, I don't have to imagine it. They're just like part of this life that I've lived, which is like a cool cheat, really makes it easier to do my job. And yeah, you just get all this like actual lived experience that you don't have to imagine. And I think that's kind of a magical like alter ego, alter life, ulterior life.
I love how you've highlighted how important the collaborations you've had thus far in your career were. But it does make me wonder, what happens when you step on set with certain expectations and you're working with someone who maybe, you know, doesn't open the door to collaboration and input as much as you'd like. What kind of things can you do to still make the most of a situation like that where things are not ideal?
Work really hard, give notes, try and make it as good as it can be, try all the time. But honestly, I get like heartbroken when that happens in a way that lasts. Like, I'm still heartbroken over a movie from like 3 years ago that was a disappointment. I'm like, gotta let it go. It's just like a job and you can move on from it. It's really something I'm trying to practice, to be like, just chill out a little bit. Not everything's gonna be like great. Not every collaboration is gonna be perfect. You can just move on and live a nice life. But I don't know. I like imagine the best version of things going in, and I really want that. And it's hard when somebody that you've put a lot of faith in can't or won't like do the thing you thought that you had agreed to do together, but just sort of does a different thing. So I don't know. Rue the day you signed up for the project. Maybe you could do that.
I understand the frustration that comes with that. Whenever I get like that about things, or like even interviews that don't go well and then keep me up for like nights on end after, it always comes from a place of caring so much. And if it means opening the door to those kinds of feelings, like, fine by me, because I never want to stop caring.
I know. It'd be nice to just be like, whatever.
I have a sister who's like, you know, the free spirit, whatever kind of person. And I'm like the rigid, intense one. I'm always like, why can't I get, couldn't I have gotten just a little bit of that? No.
Yeah.
Jumping off of the success of Halt and Catch Fire, I'm curious, was there ever an issue with being labeled a TV star when you also wanted to make movies? Or at that point, is that concept like a thing of the past? At that point, was there no divide between TV and movies anymore?
I think it was a thing of the past. I also think like Halt wasn't successful. Like, people love it now and people respected it then, but nobody watched the show. It was like a lovely secret. That is no reflection of my pride or the quality. Like, I love that show. I love that people are discovering it now, but I don't think anyone would be like, when it was successful.
A critical success. I should have phrased it that way.
Yeah, a quiet critical success. People liked it, but it kind of didn't exist. It always felt like we went to like computer camp for 4 months every year. And then we were like, why do they keep letting us go to computer camp? Nobody's like making the computers that we make, or whatever the analogy is.
It mattered in the long run. It's beloved. Yeah, it's one of those things that comes up more so than any recent show that I've watched and fell in love with. Speaking of which, actually, I'm constantly hearing talk about people wanting a reunion. And I think I was reading something recently where, like Lee said, he'd be open to doing something like that. So, like, let's say they get together and they have a reunion. Where do you think Cameron would be so many years later?
Well, we jumped a bunch of years in the show. So it was like 92 when we ended, I think. Where would she be now? Like, I don't know. I'm getting a little too granular with this. I guess her and Donna started Phoenix based on the track record of the show and their collaborations. It doesn't last long, but then there's another idea and another. I don't know. I think those five people just keep sort of like partner switching until the end of time. And they're all just like kind of horny for each other. I guess Gordon's gone, but, you know, the rest of them just enjoy the trade.
I believe that.
So I'm not sure where Cameron is. I guess that's the answer.
I mean, keep spinning that wheel, and nowadays there are a lot more tools to play with, so possibilities are endless. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Blade Runner 2049. What is something that makes Denis Villeneuve a one-of-a-kind actor's director for you? Because we're also like constantly talking about his visuals, I think more so than anything. So someone's work like that as an actor's director can kind of fall to the wayside. So what would you want people to know about him?
I think he's the greatest. We were just talking about Dune all day. What a beautiful movie. It really sounds like everything I say is sort of the same, but wow, have I never seen a director who treated every single actor as the star of the movie, every single grip, electrician, camera operator, set decorator, everybody is equally vital to producing the movie that he and we are making together. There's no hierarchy. There's like, when the actors are on set, it's the actor's set. When the director's directing, it's his set. When the camera's working, it's their set. It's filmed in absolute silence. There's no like, I mean, normally on set, you do a scene, call cut, and then there's, you know, this like enormous cacophony of people getting to work. There's so much respect for what everybody is doing, and that everybody requires the same level of respect for their job, whether they're changing sets, changing the lights, or performing in a scene. And I think like that tone of like equality and respect and admiration for everybody's like the component that they bring to this project was like a magical environment to work in.
It fills my heart so much to hear things like that about people I admire and love their work so much.
And a true like genius. I think, like, how do you have that much information in your brain to build these worlds and still, like, so much humility and admiration for the people that help you make them? I think what an outstanding type of leader that is.
I'm very glad we have 2049, but I'm also very sad we didn't get more, especially because of the situation your character's in and what I think that could have teed up. So what was it like when that movie comes out and like rave reviews across the board, beloved, all this celebration, but it just didn't get to the point where you could get another movie, because I imagine they had more for you to do.
I never was under that impression. I'm like not being coy at all. I never was like part one of Martine. What was my character's name? Marina? No.
Mariette,
sorry. Wasn't like, I was just like, whoa, this is some pretty weird, like, dream fulfillment that it's my favorite movie, and then I'm in the movie now. It felt very crazy. Also, like, that's been a lot of the stuff I've been a part of. Has not been, you know, it's not that they've been failures. I've been a part of the coolest shit. But a lot of stuff that I've done that I've loved hasn't been like an enormous sort of zeitgeisty success. And that is fine. Like, I love the stuff that I've been a part of. And some stuff has. Some stuff surprises you where you're like, wow, like, episode 3 of Black Mirror is the one that's changing my like life in a weird way. But most things sort of come out, and I don't know. I like this sort of secret-y thing about it.
No, I like looking at it that way, and to kind of weave in Station 11, because I think it is a show about appreciation of art and how it can influence in ways that you would never really imagine. So, and I'm also a big believer that no matter how I feel about a movie or show, every single thing that is made has a fan out there. And I always try to respect that. So even if it doesn't, you know, blow up the box office or something like that, I am a big believer that literally everything made makes an impression on someone out there. Yeah. And that is deeply valuable.
Yeah. Well, that's a really beautiful attitude. And I will adopt that when I start ripping something apart.
One more question about a different film before jumping into Station 11, because I've watched Happiest Season more times than I can count. And the conversation about the ending of the movie just has not stopped. There are a lot of very intense feelings about Abby's decision to forgive Harper.
I get it.
Where do you stand on that? Should Harper have been forgiven after everything she did?
No. I don't know. She was a piece of shit. But also you saw like the worst 3 days of their life. I think in the context of a movie, like, no, she sucks. She's, like, not fun. She didn't have as cool as a wardrobe as Aubrey's character. Aubrey was, like, hot and cool, and Harper was uptight and wearing, like, her mom's cocktail dress. I get it. But I also think if it was real life and not a movie, which it's not, it is a movie, you know, you have really shitty times with your partner that then you reflect on and you're like, is that you? Like, did I see the real you then? Or is the real you the rest of the time? And you kind of unpack it in this sort of slow way. But no, yeah, she was like bad and shitty. I get it. It's hard. I'm like, my feelings are, I feel bad that people hated her so much. I was like, ooh, I wish I could have figured out how to make it better. And I totally get the criticism, but I'm like, a little part of me is like, I'm sorry. Yeah, she's a shitty girl.
I understand the criticism, but in all honesty, I mean it. I think in those final conversations where she apologizes, it's your performance in particular that tips the scale for me enough that makes the ending fulfilling and satisfying and meaningful.
I walked you right into that. So thank you very much for the compliment I teed up for you.
Really have been thinking about that quite a bit. All right, Station 11. Was there anything about it that made you think, this is a good project for me to take in my career right now? Like, I can either get something from, you know, the production experience or playing this particular character.
No, I don't know why I did it. Honestly, I'm really happy I did. And it ended up being like an incredibly meaningful experience. In all honesty, I was like, so in love with Hiro Murai's work. I just thought he was the coolest person ever, and I really wanted to work with him. And I thought Patrick was incredible, and we met a bunch of times, and it just felt like they were people I really wanted to collaborate with and work alongside, and they wanted the same, and that was exciting to me. I liked their vision for the show. I thought it was beautiful, but I don't know. There's something about this show where I feel like a lot of us who worked on it have this sort of like mystical relationship with it of like, why was this a part of our lives in this moment? Like, what does it mean? It just happened at a time that was like a pretty emo year for me. It was an intense, like, emotional experience making it. Yeah, it's one of the only things like that I've had that relationship to where it hasn't been like, oh yeah, this person, because Kristen or Kirsten, I think her name should be Kirsten, but I won't get into that anymore. Kirsten, in the book is like the guide for the readers. She's a great character, but when you really look at her, there's not a ton of character in it. There's a lot of like showing the world and then some like cool descriptions about her. There's like data about her that's really interesting. But in terms of her, like the wholeness of her, we had to figure that out. Like, and Patrick had to write it, and we had to talk about it a lot and figure out like who she was and what her actual journey was so that it was compelling outside of the book and not just as a like, do you see the world after the fall? Like, this is what it looks like what's her journey. So I don't know, it's one of the only things I've ever done where I was kind of like on a ride with it.
Speaking of the timing of it all, when I first heard about it and when I first heard about the release, admittedly what went through my head is, given everything we've gone through, I don't know if I need a show about a pandemic in my life right now. Yeah. And then I watched it and I realize that it is exactly the show I need in my life right now. So what would you say to someone out there who's like, nope, got enough of this in real life, don't need it on screen?
Try shooting it. the show isn't about a pandemic. Like, the first episode and the third episode like have elements that feel recognizable, but everything else is about like, how do we survive and what's important to us and what do we hold on to and what are the most important things. And I think it manages to be like really earnest and hopeful and beautiful without being kind of too cloying or embarrassing that like, oh, okay, like that's too sweet. It's which Emily did in her book as well, I think hits this tone of like earnest hopefulness while allowing darkness and other things to be a part of that. And our show does that as well. And there's this real people searching for each other in a kind of existential sense that's pretty beautiful and quite, you know, moving, I find. But it just isn't about a pandemic. It's, you know, shitty timing. Believe us, like we started working on the show in 2019, shooting it in January and February of 2020, and then went on hiatus until the next year. Like we weren't making a show about a pandemic. We were making a show about like life after tragedy and trauma.
Is there anything about the role of the project overall that felt, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of things that felt completely different, but in a way that impacted your work? Because, you know, you do have that long break, you also move locations, and then like you have a new reality weighing on your mind as you are delivering this material. So what was the biggest difference, would you say, between, you know, who Kirsten was during the first part of production and then how you finished it out?
Well, I wasn't shooting. I wasn't supposed to start shooting until May anyway. So I didn't like begin, stop, and then revisit her. I think the ways that the pandemic affected are like endless, and it's hard to put my finger on it. Like I am exactly the same person and also feel like gravely affected by the last 2 years as everybody does. And that was going to be part of it in this really intangible way. It's hard. It's not like, I thought she should, you know, have an Amazon backpack. Like it's, I don't know. It's like, we all went through a pretty, and are going through a pretty like fucked up amorphous trauma. And that's going to influence everybody's work, whether you're like a journalist for Collider or, you know, an actor telling a story about a life after a pandemic, I think.
I have kept you too long. If you have two more minutes, we squeeze in one extra game at the end.
Great.
All right. So we are going to create your own traveling symphony. And the first thing we need to do is pick a body of work for you to perform. Something like a playwright's work, a screenwriter, a film franchise you want to reenact, you name it.
Okay, here's why I'm taking such a long pause. It's because I love and have loved for a long time and think is a great companion piece for this show, the Anne Washburn play, Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, I think that's what it's called. I saw it years and years and years ago, like 10 years ago, and it is all about this like post-apocalyptic, the first act is this post-apocalyptic scene of people sitting around a fire, trying to remember the Cape Fear episode of The Simpsons, and they're like, oh, and then what happened? Oh, and then he stepped on this. No, he was under the car, and they're like piecing it together, and then the second act is like 20 years into the future and a whole economy has been built around like selling people's memories around the Simpsons and like piecing together whole episodes based on collective memory. And then the third act is a full like baroque opera of the Cape Fear episode of The Simpsons. And it's this like really exquisite way that like story and entertainment becomes myth and or becomes like for sale and becomes a part of like capital and of the economy, and then becomes this like embedded myth that's sort of indistinguishable from religion and from like the stories we tell ourselves to survive. And I would take that play, but it's a little too meta. So I don't know the answer to give you.
Oh my, now I need to see that play. What a fascinating concept.
It's so good. So smart. But sorry, I don't know. The Simpsons. I choose The Simpsons. I love The Simpsons.
Okay. I think that is actually a very good choice. I feel like in that kind of scenario, having Simpsons out there in the world is a positive thing. Mm-hmm. So now you need to bring a director along. You could pick any director you want to be part of your traveling symphony. Who do you pick?
I'll take Sophia Tikal.
I like that. Now we need someone for the composer-conductor role. Who are you taking?
What works with The Simpsons? Well, just because none of these things really go together so far, I'm going to say Philip Glass.
Okay. I feel like Philip Glass is always the right answer with that kind of question.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I love him, and, you know, it's... It could be really intense.
So now we need a bunch of co-stars to act in this Simpsons production with Philip Glass score and Sophia Tikal direction. You could take three past co-stars with you. Who do you choose?
Well, I take Toby Huss, like, no question. He's Homer, he can be Moe, he's great with voices, can do a lot. I take, Mary Holland is so funny and so much fun to be around. And I think she could do a lot of roles and also is like a real writer, would be great. And what's another one? What have I been in? I really want to check so I can remember. I'll take Kristen Stewart. Because I just laughed all the time with her, and I think she's unbelievably talented, funny, dramatic, like, she's great.
Wait, who is Kristen playing?
Oh, shit. I don't know. I think she could be Bart. I don't know. Like, yeah, that's going to be a weird, it's going to be a weird showcase.
I mean, I like weird things. So this sounds like it's right up my alley. I must let you go now. Huge, huge thank you for joining us for Collider Ladies Night. And again, big congratulations on Station 11 and everything you've accomplished over the course of your career. Clearly, you've made a whole ton of things that I absolutely adore. So thank you and congratulations.
Thank you, Perry. This was so fun and nice. And that's it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.